Hey folks, Rob Wolf here with episode 70 of the Paleo Solution. Obviously a different intro than what you guys are used to. The big man Andy Deese is moving on doing some other projects. We're going to miss his enormous self and his enormous beard. Has been a huge help developing the podcast. It's huge help getting the book launched and going. So going to miss Andy around here. Check him out at chasingcapacity.com. That's his blog. And you can follow his future exploits. We have an even bigger hooligan to contend with now, though. We've got Greg Everett, who is famous around the world for his Olympic weightlifting book. Greg, how are you doing?
I'm doing well, although honestly, I'm a little disheartened now because I just shaved my beard off. So I feel like I might not be able to pull the job off.
You know, you're big and you had a beard once, and so you could have a beard again. So
it's true.
I think it's probably okay.
I have what would be called a transient beard. It kind of comes in during the winter and then it disappears during the summer.
Oh, I thought you meant like you were out scalping people or something like that.
No, I have not taken a transient beard. Okay. That's a whole different facial hair situation.
We definitely didn't check references on you, but I guess like the only references you would have would be us, since like
exactly.
You started at NorCal Strength and Conditioning. So
it's an infinite feedback loop. It won't get you anywhere.
Okay, cool. Well, that works. So what's new? You just got back from the Arnolds.
Yeah, Ohio is lovely this time of year. Any of you get a chance, go check it out. It's definitely not gray and raining and snowy and freezing and depressing.
Don't they have a beach there somewhere?
They probably have an indoor beach volleyball place somewhere.
Hmm.
I'm sure. They do have a convention center that's got to be like 60 acres.
I guess you kind of need that in Ohio because you don't really want to go outside either in the summer or the winter. So
that's correct.
So what was going down there? What were you doing?
It's the Arnold Sports Vest Festival, as I believe the official name for it. But basically, it's a big yearly thing they put on, and they bring in all kinds of sports, and weightlifting is one of them. So it's quite a circus. There's a You kind of have these huge crowds of people milling through this convention center, and there's a weightlifting competition going on one side. There's, you know, powerlifting in another room. There's a bunch of fencing stuff. There's MMA and BJJ, and I think there's usually some gymnastics and all kinds of fun stuff. I think that there's actually CrossFit there as of last year.
Mm-hmm.
Although I unfortunately did not get a chance to check out the CrossFit room this time.
Huh.
I'm sure
that they had a name tag waiting for you at the door.
I suspect they did. It was probably laced with some kind of transdermal poison.
They would have the access for that, so I could see it. So didn't you have a couple of lifters there? Do you have a couple of people you were coaching at that gig?
We did. We had Amy, we had Kara Yessi / Doherty, Jocelyn Forrest, and Diane Fu.
Nice.
And so it turned out pretty well. All of them got at least one PR. Kara got three. She got a meat snatch PR, meat clean and jerk PR, and meat total PR. So that's what I mean by three. And Jocelyn just annihilated an 82 kilo snatch, looking really good. 96 kilo clean and jerk, which was actually
nice.
Considerably less than we expected going into it, but she had a little bit of a caffeine fiasco between the snatch and clean and jerk, so that did not work out well.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
She basically had her little yerba mate thing in her carry-on bag and forgot about it, and so TSA and their infinite wisdom and not understanding that Jocelyn Forrest needed to get super jacked before her clean and jerks took it away. A little disappointing.
Uppers, downers, you know.
Well, yeah, that's cool. So, you know, fortunately, there was a huge bodybuilding convention right across the way, and a couple folks went and got her some kind of small bottled energy product, which would probably show up positive on a drug test for some kind of banned substance. So hopefully that doesn't work out.
Well, you can always, isn't it always the deal though, that somebody gave it to me? Isn't that
yeah.
usually the deal? So like you could, you know, you could document it on film, like No, dude, really. They ran across the way and got it from, well, the guy's bigger than a house, but I don't know what was in it. And yeah.
Well, that was one of the Ben Johnson stories, right? That someone spiked his drink while he was waiting in drug testing.
Yeah. So I wish somebody would spike my drink with some, you know, anabolic substances. I could probably handle that, but probably not going to happen anytime soon. I guess you have to actually be a competitive athlete for that to happen. So
just got to eat more sweet potatoes, Rob.
Okay, that's true.
Fill your
cool,
right
man.
Out.
So you ready to carve into this stuff? We've got some goodies here.
I'm ready. You're the one who's got to get your propeller hat spinning and actually answer the questions.
We'll see what we can do. I'm sure we can make a train wreck of this thing in no time flat. So
yes.
let's give it a crack.
All right, we got some pretty good ones here today. So this first one, we got a question from a no-name follower of the podcast who asks, Rob, could you comment on the following new UK guidelines concerning red meat? And just to really quickly summarize this whole study, since he quoted the whole thing and I don't want to read it. In the first new guidelines since 1998, Britain advised people to help prevent cancer by cutting down on steaks, hamburgers, sausages, and other red meat. Government experts say people should eat no more than 500 grams or 1 pound of red meat a week, or 70 grams, 2.5 ounces every day, significantly less than it previously recommended. That works out to about one small lamb chop a day. hold on, it gets funny.
Is that like the puppet or? <It's>
I don't know. Where does lamb chop end? Does it include the person operating? Because then that's a whole lot of meat.
That's what I want to know. Like, if I get to eat lamb chop and the person operating it, then I'm probably cool with that.
Yeah. That's no problem. So, scientists think people who eat a lot of meat like lamb, roast beef, and ham have higher risk of bowel cancer. In 2005, a large European study found people who ate about 160 grams or 5.6 ounces of red meat a day bumped up their bowel cancer risk by one-third compared to people who ate the least meat. On average, people have a 1 in 19 chance of developing bowel cancer in their lifetime. High levels of meat consumption have also been linked to cancers of the breast, bladder, stomach, and pancreas. Well, I don't have breasts, so I'm going to go ahead and continue.
You're feeling confident there?
Well, that's 25% less, percent less risk.
That's true. Okay. Yeah, with each one, I think. So it should be 50% less risk.
Yes.
Yeah.
Experts suspect that hame, the pigment which gives red meat its color, damages cells in the digestive system, which may lead to cancer. Cooking meat at high temperatures, like on a barbecue, may also produce cancer-causing chemicals. Finally, Britain's new guidelines match advice issued by the World Cancer Research Fund several years ago. In 2007, the agency advised against eating too much processed meat like sausages or bacon and said children should never eat such products. It's estimated that cutting down on red meat could save 3,800 Britons from dying of bowel cancer every year.
Oh, man.
Your thoughts, Rob?
Lots of thoughts. You know, these studies are great in that, you know, it's definitely a good, I guess, learning opportunity, but they're really buggerish because, you know, what these things always are is an epidemiological study. So some statistics typically taken from food journals are analyzed and then get kind of crunched. And inevitably, you just kind of find what you want to go looking for. And so if you're looking for particular items to be problematic, then you definitely find them to be problematic. That last study that was mentioned, you know, the 2007 study where they we're talking about processed meats, is, I believe, the same one or a related study that popped up where they were counting meat that was on pizza. They would count the total caloric content of that whole item as pizza.
And it makes sense.
Or as meat, you know? So, like, right. If you had a couple of pieces of pepperoni, then, like, the whole Marianne, the protein, the carbs, the fat, the whole thing was then counted as, quote, meat. And this is inevitably what you see with these things.
Sure.
They actually do at least put forward an idea here that, you know, perhaps heme, which is a iron-rich element of most proteins, particularly red meats and any type of, like, highly vascularized type of meat, then we get more kind of iron-rich heme proteins in there. And iron is definitely a pro-oxidant. It definitely could be pro-inflammatory, pro-oxidative. But this is going, it sniffs really similarly. They used to think that bile salts were in some way a gut irritant, and they, you know, they worked and worked and worked to prove that thing. But at least what they've got here, they've got a proposed mechanism that, you know, we think that this is the problem. But then what you need to do is actually go and look at the literature and see what the heck is going on with that. And what you find is that even ingesting like a you know, reduced forms of iron directly in animal models, we're not finding increased rates of cancers. You know, and so we're even removing the iron from being associated with the proteins in the heme complex, and we're not finding cancer in these situations. And so these are some very mechanistic direct things, which I think, you know, like we've talked about when we had Matt Lalonde on here and everything, like we really need to hang our hats on the mechanism. But if we want to pull this back to like a 30,000 foot level and we start looking at like some epidemiology out of your, you know, epidemiology turning into anthropology, like the Inuit, the Aceh Indians of Peru, the Maasai, these folks are consuming a ton of heme-bearing proteins, and they're not suffering any of these cancers. And so there's, you know, that's not proof. That's some interesting stuff. But, you know, with this particular item, when it's, you know, what are my thoughts on it? I think it's really weak from an epidemiological standpoint. We have exceptions to this supposed rule. And then even on the mechanistic side, it's pretty weak as to their proposed mechanism of causation here. Whereas, again, if we start looking at insulin-spiking foods, we've got a much higher we have some mechanism there that's pretty tight. Insulin-like growth factor, insulin epithelial growth factors, changes in the liver pathology that starts basically a feed-forward mechanism with more growth factors and pathology. So, yeah, I'm just not a huge fan. You have anything else that you could hike your leg on this one with, or is that—
I like meat.
There you go.
Done.
Done.
Well, you know, like you said, the big thing is that these studies that go searching for this single super detailed mechanism being the root of some huge problem just seem fundamentally silly to me.
It is if the mechanism, you know, they throw it out there, but they obviously didn't look in the research to even see if exposures to high iron-containing compounds was pathogenic in the gut, and just not really finding that.
It seems like a good starting point.
It seems like a great starting point, you know, but instead they're just kind of drawing at straws here, really trying very, very hard to hang this stuff on meat consumption. So,
yeah. Well, but we actually have another question that's going to be a perfect follow-up to this. And I'm super excited about this one. I'm not going to lie.
You're going to be shocked. My response is actually going to be more.
Yeah, I just don't know what to expect.
There may just be a small mushroom cloud over Chico here soon.
Yeah. Take a few breaths and center yourself for a moment. You ready?
I'm ready to go. Yep.
So Sean asks, I was wondering your take on the raw vegan diet. I fully agree on the vegan diet you are on being bad, but on the raw vegan side of things, I don't see people getting sick on a raw vegan diet that is mostly grain/dairy free.
Well, this is one of those interesting things, but you know, the folks who recommend it, I would say like the really loud vocal people who recommend a vegan approach, say like John McDougall, he actually bans people from talking about the grain and legume free raw vegan approach. Like they are not allowed to comment on his website. And so there's actually this kind of funny schism among the vegan crowd in that I would say the more mainstream guys, the more medicalized guys who are recommending soy and grains and legumes the way that McDougall is, they don't like talking about this stuff at all, because these raw food vegans are actually saying pretty much the same things with regards to like the gut irritation. They're saying all the same things regarding grains and legumes that you would typically get out of the paleo camp. And so it's kind of interesting from that regard. You know, I obviously don't think that the vegan approach is optimum for health, optimum for performance. I would love everybody to give it a shot for a month, you know, give the raw food vegan shot a month and,
No thanks.
Greg will pass, but you know, but then
you can't eat raw nachos, Rob.
Well, you could try. It would be a fun attempt to give it a shot. But you know, it's like, give that thing a shot. You know, try it out. Try that pony for a month and see what happens. And then try a standard kind of paleo gig for a month. And then try, you know, the Wendler, you know, grandma test and nachos for a month and just see what you like, you know, see which one works best for you, you know. But with this thing, I would say that if somebody is like morally set on being vegan, that you would be smart to steer away from grains and legumes and eat tubers, eat a lot of nuts and seeds, sprout them. You know, I don't think it's going to be optimum. And we're, you know, other than maybe a few people who have really good genetics and go into endurance athletics, they might be able to pull this thing off in endurance athletics. I know there's kind of a rash of this stuff going around the MMA scene. It'll be kind of funny to see where all that stuff goes, but it's just not really optimum. But, it, you know, maybe I'm wrong. Get in, try it on, check it out. But it is interesting that there is a rather large vocal group of vegans who say pretty much the same things about grains and legumes that I'm saying, but then they're also, you know, dead set against protein intake. And like Greg said in the previous deal, you know, meat rocks. So can't really go down that road.
So now let's say for a moment you do have a client who is vegan or vegetarian, and their reasonings are moral or ethical in nature rather than, you know, based on health. You know, what's your recommendation to them to optimize that suboptimal approach? How are they getting, you know, what are their protein source options?
You know, you're relying on some hemp. You might end up doing some concentrated soy protein, like some concentrated pea proteins. You're really limited. You know, I mean, the concentrated protein sources are very, very limited at that point. I think probably one of the smartest things to do is make sure you're covering your B12 side. All the B vitamin issues can be pretty dramatic for a vegan or pretty hardcore vegetarian. I was talking with Lauren Cordain on the phone the other day, and he's really tackling the vegan and vegetarian question heavy duty in his next book. And it's probably going to get him some hate mail because he's really taking this stuff to task, whereas in the first book he really kind of skirted the whole topic. But you know, you're going to have to do some supplementation to shore up some gaps in the game. And I think doing like some algae-derived DHA is a must-do proposition, especially for women, of childbearing, you know, age, if they want to have kids and have adequate levels of EPA and DHA in their body to feed that growing fetus. Those are some things that they absolutely have to do. But you know, I even from that moralistic level, I would recommend that people read the Vegetarian Myth, and a lot of the arguments that are thrown out there on the sustainability side, on the least harm side. It's not the definitive answer coming out of the vegan vegetarian camp. There are other voices out there that have commentary on that stuff. And I would just recommend that people do a little bit of reading, do a little bit of homework on it, and then draw whatever conclusions they want to. But that's not the definitive story on the economics of the whole thing. And certainly right. Not the best place to go for performance, health, and longevity, for sure.
You don't say.
You don't see a lot of Bulgarian vegan Olympic weightlifting gold medalists out there, and you would think that if that was really the cat's meow, that the, you know, these folks would have tinkered with it and done it, and instead you see something that looks like a cyclic ketogenic diet that's real heavy in protein and fat and, you know, carbohydrate as per recovery needs.
Yeah.
So yeah,
that sounds good. That sounds fancy.
I'm hungry right now.
It sounds
actually
a lot fancier than it looks.
Totally.
You have such a great way of putting things in really complicated terms.
I do what I can. Thank you.
Yes. All right. So this is actually another good one that kind of connects to the previous question. Speaking of veganism and such. AJ asks, I was reading in On Food and Cooking by Harold McGee that prolonged boiling of legumes deactivates lectins and protease inhibitors. It does not go into specifics and wondered if you could shed any light on it. How much to boil? Do certain legumes respond better? What other things should one consider if boiling them stops two of the major reasons were to avoid legumes?
You know, the both sprouting and boiling decrease the activity of protease inhibitors, phytates, lectins, even to some degree saponins get denatured or broken down in the boiling or the sprouting process. The problem is that it doesn't remove all of them. And so what you're then dealing with is still, in my opinion, a suboptimal food. Now, if you just really, really love kidney beans or something like that, then I would recommend soaking them, sprouting them, pressure cooking them, which is going to cook them at a high temperature. When you pressure cook them, I would put a couple of tablespoons of vinegar in with the mix, because that acidic medium is going to hydrolyze a lot of those proteins and further help to break down the lectins. But still, what you're dealing with is a suboptimal food, from a nutrient standpoint, from a gut irritation standpoint. But say, like, you're super broke and you're trying to get by on just, like, literally nickels and dimes. That's a good way to go. You put some money into a pressure cooker, you buy a big bottle of white vinegar, and you put a couple of tablespoons into each, batch that you're pressure cooking. Sprout them first, and that's going to help. As to, like, there being differences with all this stuff, there's definitely differences, but the lectins are fairly similar. This is just kind of an argument. If you're going to eat this stuff, probably rotate through them, because you're going to get a different variety of lectins, a different kind of toxin load based on the type of foods that you're taking in. So I would rotate between, like, black beans and kidney beans and all that. But still, again, at the end of the day, I would just steer people towards, like, yams and sweet potatoes and all that sort of stuff, and then get a largely protein source, from animal products.
Yeah, it seems like an inordinate amount of time and effort just to eat beans.
Yeah.
Go through all that.
I mean, it's that third world solution where, like, if this is what you've got, then by all means you do it, but you process it in a way that stacks the deck more in your favor. But if that's not your situation, and this is, again, being iconoclastic about it and just trying to steer people towards the best options that I can. But when we know that this stuff causes a lot of gut irritation, and granted, like, I'll have some beans and rice once, maybe twice a week going out doing some Mexican food. But if I do it consistently, I start getting some acid reflux and some other GI problems. And so I know for myself it's a problem. And so just as a baseline, this is where I'm recommending, in general, steer away from that stuff. Make it kind of a when you're out, going out, kick your heels up kind of a meal. Again, nachos, perfect time to fit that in. So, that's where I would roll that stuff in, unless your situation is very, very specific and we're trying to deal with, a really, really tough economic situation or something like that. But even then, there have been some really good articles. Diane Sanfilippo did a paleo on a shoestring kind of gig on at Balanced Bites and all that. So you can eat on the cheap and still eat paleo. You know, you can do it smart. So
sweet.
And still have nachos on Fridays. So
you could also just get super skinny and then you just have to eat less.
Yeah, you can do that.
There's all kinds of solutions.
That's like CrossFitting in the zone.
Yeah. Should I be concerned that I've had 13 almonds today?
No.
Am I going to get fat?
Yes, you will.
Sweet. All right. Well, that's enough on beans.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm feeling flatulent just talking about it. So.
All right. So I like this question because it's a super epic, complicated question on one very simple topic.
Right.
And it just kind of makes me laugh. So, nothing personal, James. But James asks, well, first he says, thanks for teaching me about the many benefits of coconut. That said, I have a few questions. One, I've read that coconut contains phytic acid. Should I be concerned about this? Does coconut meat perhaps contain more phytic acid than coconut milk and coconut oil? If so, would you recommend that we soak or ferment coconut meat or perhaps avoid it altogether? James separated this into three questions, but this first one had multiple questions, so he's trying to fool you.
People always do that. There ends up being like 15 questions.
I have a quick question that I'm going to compose in this 18-page email.
Of 38 sub-questions.
Number two, do you recommend refined or unrefined coconut oil? It sounds like unrefined has more nutrients, but it also has a lower smoke point. And in parentheses, would you dare cook in unrefined coconut oil? I double dog dare you, Rob.
I would like the sound from Psycho when they open the curtain and the
Well, hang on, we're not done. Number three, the third and final question. I noticed that So Delicious sells a cultured coconut milk product. Would you recommend this cultured version over regular coconut milk? And then finally, wait, I'd love to hear some of your godlike insights. So I want you to take a moment and muster your godlike insight creating process before you answer.
I feel omnipotent.
Most of you won't get that joke, but yeah, you should laugh anyway.
There's a whole massive backstory with that, which someday we may be able to divulge, but right now we can't. But just remember, I feel omnipotent.
There's at least four people in the world who know what we're talking about, including us.
They're either choking on their latte or they're loading a gun right now, one or the other.
All right. So, coconuts.
Okay, back to the question. So, coconut has a sparing, like, tiny amount of phytic acid. Like, I would not worry about it. You know, the coconut meat is totally good to go. The coconut milk is good to go. I wouldn't really worry about that. You know, as to the smoke point, like, I just wouldn't cook the daylights out of most things unless it really kind of calls for it. And even then, you know, the refined versus unrefined coconut oils, like, you can cook at a pretty high temperature with it. So I tend to like the flavor of the unrefined coconut better. And even if it has a slightly lower smoke point, because it has some other organic constituents in there that start burning at a lower smoke point, I just don't know how often you need to cook that hot. So I wouldn't really worry about it. And then the cultured coconut milk is pretty badass. Like, that stuff is super cool, but it's an apples and oranges thing. Like, I would use that in a totally different format than I would coconut milk, you know, like using it for I wouldn't use cultured coconut milk to make a curry because I'm cooking it and I'm going to kill all the cultures.
So. The cultured coconut milk is the one you want to bring home to meet your parents because it'll impress them.
Yes.
You can talk about art, music.
Hi, I'm cultured coconut milk. How are you?
All right.
That would make a great Family Guy deal.
Let's move on before I bury that one any further.
We're definitely down to four listeners.
All right.
Heading towards three.
Yeah, I'm definitely not going to listen to this one.
Yeah.
All right. So this next one was actually a two-part one, but the two parts are wholly unrelated.
Right.
So I'm going to stick to the first part, which I think is actually much more interesting for everybody.
Yeah.
So, again, this is nameless, so I apologize for your lack of recognition on the internet. But as a standard, thanks for the podcast. Has made a huge difference in my life. Have two questions for you, but I will try to make them as brief as possible while providing enough background to make it answerable. Let's just do the first question.
Yeah.
My mother cannot sleep without antidepressants. I convinced her to do a no grains, legumes, dairy, nightshade, paleo trial for her health problems after the success I've had so far. However, when she went off of antidepressants, she didn't sleep for a week and reverted back to having panic attacks, resulting in going right back to antidepressants. I've been catching up on the podcast and I'm currently reading Lights Out. I've convinced her of how important getting enough sleep is, but without antidepressants, she literally cannot sleep a blank. I definitely need some help as I'm very concerned. She tried melatonin and some magnesium, but no success. Please pull out all the stops on this one, or at least try to point me to the right resources. I've exhausted the power of the standard Google search. See, sounds like it's time for more godlike insights, Rob.
Well, I may be coming up a little short on this one. I mean, there's a, you know, definitely eating better is going to make people healthier. Healthier typically means that people should be sleeping better. But I mean, this sounds like a really serious medical condition, and it's very, very true. Like, the sleep is critical for health and to say nothing of survival. So, I mean, looking around for somebody like a functional medicine doctor who can do some detailed endocrinology, like look at what her thyroid is doing, try to get some sense of where like serotonin, melatonin, dopamine, acetylcholine, where all that stuff is going on. Some sort of a full inventory, looking at gut health and all that obviously is important, but at this point, like, if you need some sort of antidepressants, it's interesting. One of the main features of most antidepressants is that they normalize sleep function. and the interplay of sleep and depression and feeling good and mood is just, you know, massively woven together. I would say inseparable. And so at this point, it's like, you know, do what you need to do to, you know, eat as healthy as you can. But then, it seems obvious to stick with what's been working for her for potentiating the sleep. But you certainly can keep looking. I would try to track down like a functional medicine doc or possibly doing some work with a naturopath who's pretty savvy with this stuff and see what else you can dig up. There might be some thyroid issues or some other under the hood issues that are causing more of a problem here. But, you know, not sleeping for a week is not a tenable situation like that. That just doesn't work. So,
yeah, it's kind of one of those things where you'd like the antidepressants to be a temporary solution. But at some point, you have to accept the fact that no matter how nasty the drug is, it's got to be better for you than never sleeping.
Yeah, because, I mean, you will get sick and die without the sleep. That's just all there is to it.
It's true. So, I've seen The Machinist.
Yeah. So, I mean, tough situation. Play with this stuff. You know, please do keep us posted on what you're doing. But, you know, for right now, it's being overly idealistic about this thing isn't going to solve the problem for sure.
Yeah. Well, sorry we couldn't get a complete godlike insight on that one, but... It's a good start.
We'll just make something up next time and then see what happens. So,
you really are omnipotent.
Yes, that seems to be the way that works. Just make it up when you're, in a corner and you're afraid of saying I don't know. So, yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, this next one is should probably be a little easier for you. We're just, you know, I'm going to give it to you full throttle today, Rob. We're not going to hold back. I expect big things.
Do it, man. Do it.
I like, it's interesting too. I feel a little bit goofy reading some of these because they've come in email form, so they're missing a lot of words some of the time. So just please understand that this isn't me speaking, it's me reading. For example, have read your book and been following the diet pretty well for the last 6 weeks. I've had relatively good success thus far. I'm pretty sure I have a gluten intolerance as I seem to have skin or allergy issues every time it sneaks back into my diet. It also seems like I may have some issues with nuts and soy, possibly dairy. My problem is I go 3 to 4 weeks clean paleo, but if I break, there are always multiple items that leak back in, so it's hard to narrow down what is problematic. Also, it's hard to decide if there really is a relationship between skin issues and food intolerance. What's your opinion on food sensitivity testing? I've been considering doing the blood test by ALCAT worldwide. This would give me a way to highlight multiple possible food allergies at once and I guess give some credibility to my thoughts on my food sensitivities. Is there any value to this type of blood test or should I just refocus and try an elimination diet for another 6 weeks? Thanks for your time and all the great information.
You know, the ALCAT stuff is cool, but not all of the response, you know, like in dermatitis and eczema, it's not an allergy response. It's actually like autoimmune / like psoriasis is actually a low grade form of skin cancer. It's abnormal cell growth, but just happening at a very, very low level. None of that stuff is going to pop up on an allergy test, the ALCAT test, but all of it responds to, you know, grain, legume, dairy free eating. I would stick it more heavily towards like the gluten and dairy side of things than I would with legumes specifically, but phytohemagglutinin can also be problematic in this, which we find that in a number of different beans. And so this is that deal where it's like, if the problem is really a big enough issue for you, then you just stick to the program. If it's not that big a deal, then you deal with the skin issues. And that's really all it boils down to. At the talk that we had this weekend, there were some really cool dudes that came, some functional medicine docs, and they're really cool, really knowledgeable, hoping to do some work with them in the future. But it's interesting because they are in a medical practice. They lead with lab work. And since I work in a gym, I lead with trying to get people results. And you know, they pay me for essentially coaching, and part of that coaching involves the nutrition. And so what I actually try to get people to do is do what's going to work and work now. And so you can fart around with this thing all you want, spend a bunch of money on food testing. And if that's what you need to do to convince yourself that it's going to fly, then that's great. But the problem with the food testing frequently is that it's not comprehensive enough to actually tell you the full picture. So you go spend a couple of thousand dollars on tests, and it doesn't give you the full picture, and then you're still kind of wringing your hands wondering whether or not this is really the problem versus just simply really keeping it out of your diet. So it makes me, you know, I know I sound like kind of a dick with it, but it's just, if it's a big enough deal for you, you'll fix it, and if you won't, then you don't.
We're all used to you sounding like a dick. Don't worry about it.
Perfect. So, you know, that's the way I would tackle it. And maybe someday I'll start selling a bunch of diagnostic medical stuff off of the website, and you'll suddenly hear me change my tune. I'm like, oh, yeah, man, we need to do some very extensive testing. And you know, honestly, some of the Cyrex Labs testing stuff actually looks pretty legit and might actually provide some insight in this, because it's looking at a number of the different isoforms of transglutaminase antibodies, like forms 3 and 5, which specifically affect dermatological issues. So maybe we will get enough insight into that where we could recommend without a lot of reservation, yeah, dude, go check out the Cyrex Lab stuff. And then when you've got your validation, then go do the elimination diet and then figure out whether or not it's worthwhile for you. But it still, to me, is kind of a rope-a-dope. It's like, you know that this is a thing. The deal with the Cyrex Lab stuff, I guess, that's cool is that we may find out if some other things like coffee and some other kind of stuff that you wouldn't think would be problematic, this stuff may be ferreting out that they are, in fact, a problem. And that's where I would be like, okay, there's maybe some weight to that.
I agree. That's the entirety of my thoughts on that subject.
It's very comprehensive, though. It's very comprehensive.
Rob, please share my opinion on this. All right. Yeah. So this next one is a pretty epic topic, and it comes up a lot. So this could be a quick answer, or it could be 4 hours. So let's steer more towards the quick side of things.
We'll go quick.
Yeah. Hello, Rob. That's with an exclamation point. I was wondering if you could recommend some information or resources for paleo and CrossFit combined with pregnancy. I just thought of a couple answers, but I'm not going to share them. My current CrossFit gym has never had a pregnant member, and I have seen so many mixed opinions all over the web on both subjects. Do you have any suggestions or changes I should be making to both diet and exercise? Also, prenatal vitamins, yes or no? I'm guessing no, because so many contain soy. Ew. So many more questions, but this should tide me over. Thanks. JC. I like JC. She's got a lot of enthusiasm.
She's got some charisma. She had her double espresso in the morning. So
yes.
You know, the paleo shtick with pregnancy is great. We've done a number of blog posts on this, you know, with regards to the nutrient density, how good it is for the mom, how good it is for the little ones. Everyday Paleo has done a bunch of stuff on this. Everydaypaleo.com, growinguppaleo.com. Between the two women, you've got 4 kids that have been, you know, essentially like raised, born, bred, paleo. And then with the CrossFit deal, it's just, you know, don't be an idiot with it. Like, approach things in a reasonable, progressive manner. Now, the challenge with that is you never really know what the quality of the coaching is. You don't know what the culture is within the particular gyms. Within our gym, you know, very early on, we stopped doing .com programming. And this is back in like 2005. We started doing our own programming because we didn't like what was going on then, and the programming then was way better than it is now. So if you're going to, you know, like you start, when you're pregnant, you start releasing a hormone called relaxin, which starts allowing ligaments to lengthen because it allows the birth canal to open up and all that. And so you need to be careful with that stuff, but it's basically you keep doing the same stuff you've been doing and just be kind of careful and progressive in what you're doing. And as you get heavier and as your essentially belly gets bigger, there's going to become certain things that become uncomfortable. And when they become uncomfortable, then I recommend this wacky thing, which is that you stop doing them. And we've had a number of people work out in the morning of the day that they gave birth. But, you know, they weren't doing Fran. They came in and did some rowing and did a couple of body rows and kind of stretched and wiggled and moved around. And all that stuff is good for you. It's good for the baby, too. It reduces stress, and it just kind of keeps the blood moving, and you feel good, and you're, you know, you're actually in shape. It's kind of funny when I see obstetricians recommend that people don't work out during their pregnancy. I mean, nobody would think about, or typically don't think about, running a marathon without doing any training for it. But yet, you know, getting pregnant and having a baby, like, there's no expectation you should be in shape for that. And it seems damn silly. So I think that CrossFit and paleo could be great for a pregnant mom. You know, do the paleo smart, do the CrossFit smarter, as to a prenatal. I don't really see, you know, I would do it maybe a couple of times a week. I see a lot of people not feel good on a prenatal. So I would just kind of go with how you feel. And if you supplemented anything, I would supplement some DHA heavy fish oil to make sure you've got enough omega-3s for the little one's brain development. And make sure your vitamin D levels are 60 to 80 nanograms per deciliter. Like, good vitamin D really helps modify your immune response and can prevent some other problems during pregnancy. So that's it.
Easy. It's the intuitive approach. Don't
easy
be
is
stupid.
Getting knocked up in Chico.
Well, I think that's the most shocking part of this question is that no one in her CrossFit gym has gotten knocked up.
Yeah, because all the gyms that I've seen and our gym, like, you have to, like, try not to get pregnant. I don't know what's
CrossFit
going on.
CrossFit gyms are
that.
Like baby farms in my experience.
Yeah, yeah. So that is odd. I don't know if it's like, you know, 99 dudes and one chick, and the one chick is, you know, menopausal age or something. But yeah, that's odd. That's odd.
Yeah. Well. All right.
Yeah, we could digress all kinds of directions with that.
I'll save the remainder of my thoughts on that one.
Yeah, we'll do a highlight reel show at some point, and we'll throw some of that stuff in there.
Every show is a highlight reel.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
So our next nameless individual asks or says, "I follow." I'm sorry. I'm going to start this over again.
I just have to mention to people that Greg was a English instructor at Chico State University, even while he was doing his English undergrad. So he's outstanding just in English diction in general, has written a number of books, was an editor and publisher of books. And so what's hanging him up is that there's supposed to be an ing after the word follow to make it following, but in fact there's not.
I just
and it's giving him an aneurysm right now. So.
Well, I just it sounds so awesome to say I'm follow a pretty strict paleo diet. And I kind of wanted to go back and do it the way the person intended because it's a little more artistic.
It's performance art, just like Kelly Starrett would say. It is definitely performance art here. But this is what's going on. Greg would frequently correct both Nikki and I, who I think we usually do pretty well on our English grammar, and he would bust our ass pretty frequently. So this is just funny.
Well, all of you who read the performance menu in its early days, I just wish that we could go back for the fun of it and republish those issues with the original Rob Wolf articles. Because it would just be fantastic. It was amazing.
They're in my email, so we could pull a few of them out and just do a compare and contrast. What Rob submitted, what Greg edited, would be pretty funny.
But it's just this like fascinating product of German as a first language translated into English, and then just with a dash of Rob Wolf character in there. It's just phenomenal.
It's broken.
And,
it's broken.
You know, as gnarly as it was to edit those things down, I got to say it was enjoyable on some level.
Well, you just knew that you were working with an idiot, so yeah.
All right, let's talk about oatmeal.
Okay.
He's following a pretty strict paleo diet other than eating organic oatmeal with berries and nuts 3 to 4 times a week for breakfast. When I started paleo, I was on a gluten-free diet for a couple months. I then added oat back to my diet and didn't notice any negative effects, so I've kept eating it, mainly because I really like oatmeal. It's easy and fast to do in the morning, easy to store, and cheap as dirt, even when organic and uncontaminated by other grains. Recent European studies suggest that even most people diagnosed with celiac disease can eat pure, uncontaminated oat without any trouble. In a Finnish study that lasted 5 years, 12 celiacs ate oat for 5 years, while a control group was on a strict gluten-free diet. The biopsies showed no differences in the densities of CD3, IEL, and IEL T cells between two groups. What is your take on oat?
Well, you know, it's this thing again where, like, if you don't feel like it's causing you a problem, then God love you, run with it. You know, I do think that we could check, like, interleukin 15, which is one of the really important pieces when we're looking at the gut permeability, gut pathology story. When gliadin or avenin out of oats, it typically isn't hydrolyzed or broken down at that enterocyte interface in the gut. When it makes it into the backside of the enterocyte where it could interact with immune cells, this is where we usually get an immune response and the release of interleukin 15, and we get some breakdown in the enterocytes, release of zonulin, tight junctions dissolve, and all that sort of stuff. I'm suspecting that we would probably see that because we see it with corn in some individuals, we see it with rice in some individuals. I'm still in that, I guess, kind of lunatic fringe side where I think in general this stuff is still causing some problems in general relative to doing things like, you know, yams, sweet potatoes, all that sort of jive. But again, you know, we may have some genetic variations where people are able to much better tolerate this. We may have a situation in which we have certain populations that legitimately don't express any type of inflammatory response to various types of grains. And if that's the case, then by all means, eat them as per your, you know, heart's content. But the thing that's interesting with this, though, is that, you know, we get a lot of studies that look at one or two biological, you know, say like inflammatory pathways, and that there's just so many different areas in which these, gliadin is just one, or avenin are just one of these potentially immunologically active proteins. And there's tons of other constituents in these grains that can be and are biologically active. And so it still begs the question, like, is this really the best thing to be doing? And my nervousness about some stuff like this is that we've just had so darn much success with the autoimmune scene that this starts pacifying people into saying, oh, we can do some oats, we can do this, we can do that, and that they won't try a full elimination diet first and then see if it will really help them. And, you know, for years, people have been told to do oats when they have celiac, and they still end up developing other collateral problems, thyroid dysregulation, some other problems. And, you know, these studies that are being cited, like the Finnish study, both these studies are observational, you know, essentially food log type studies. So we still don't know for sure what's going on. So theoretically, you know, these groups are eating a gluten-free diet. Theoretically, these groups are only eating the oats. We don't really know for sure what the heck they're doing at all because it's not very well controlled. So I don't know. At the end of the day, if you like your oats and it's a convenient deal for you, by all means, go for it. If you ever, want to cycle it out and just see if you have any type of improvement, obviously I would probably put a stamp of endorsement on that.
Well, and also keep in mind that Fruity Pebbles are gluten-free. And they're they're clearly from the Stone Age. So it seems to be the perfect paleo breakfast food.
Well, Cocoa Pebbles would fly in there too. So
yeah, I like Sue, it. You got your bases covered for breakfast. You know, I don't know why you got to get crazy with oatmeal.
Yeah, and Fruity Pebbles are good too. I miss that stuff.
All right,
cool.
That's enough of this.
So is that it for this? The round one. We've got episode 70 on the books.
Yep.
Cool, man. Well, thank you for the help. And we did try some different recording stuff. So for the folks that have been buggered by the sound quality, it will either be better, worse, or the same. Stay tuned.
Yes. We'll get it fully jiggified one of these days.
Cool. Right on, G. Talk to you soon.
All right. See ya.